From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Game show host, CIA assassin, or both? On today's Fresh Air, we feature a 1986 interview with Chuck Barris, the creator and host of The Dating Game, The Newlywed Game, and The Gong Show. The new film, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, is based on Barris's autobiography, in which he claims he worked for the CIA while hosting game shows. Also, actress and hip-hop artist Queen Latifah. She's currently starring in the film adaptation of Chicago as Mama, a no-nonsense prison warden. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Pianist. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the U.S. will not be intimidated or panicked by North Korea's withdrawal from the international treaty that bans the spread of nuclear weapons. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
After a meeting with the head of the U.N. nuclear agency, Mohammed Al-Baradei, Powell told State Department reporters that the U.S. will continue to work the channels of diplomacy with friends and allies to find a peaceful solution. If North Korea shows it's serious about resolving the issue, Powell says, the Bush administration is ready to listen.
But we will not enter into any kind of talk or dialogue where North Korea is given any impression that they have any choice but to come into compliance with their obligations to the international community.
North Korea has been holding private talks since Thursday with New Mexico's Governor Bill Richardson, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Powell says he's been in frequent contact with Richardson, but he offered no assessment. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News at the State Department.
Illinois Governor George Ryan has pardoned four death row inmates, saying their confessions were obtained by torture.
Without any doubt in my mind, these four men were wrongfully prosecuted and wrongfully sentenced to die. I reviewed these cases over on many occasions, and I, without a doubt, believe injustice has occurred. I believe that these men are innocent, or I wouldn't have pardoned them.
Ryan declared a moratorium on executions 2 years ago, saying the state's criminal justice system has been unfair. The governor, who's about to leave office, said he'd announce the results of almost 150 more petitions for clemency tomorrow. Federal officials are finishing their investigation of Wednesday's crash of a commuter plane in Charlotte, North Carolina. The U.S. Airways Express plane crashed shortly after takeoff, killing all 21 people aboard. Amy Quinton reports from member station WFAE in Charlotte.
Earlier, investigators discovered the plane's pitch increased sharply during takeoff. Pitch is controlled by the elevator in the tail of the plane. NTSB spokesman John Golia said Friday they found no damage to the cables that help control the plane.
We have continuity, which means we have a solid connection for the control cables going to the tail. And that would tend to eliminate any problems between the control column and the operation of the elevators.
Investigators are also confident whatever caused the crash was isolated. Air Midwest, which was operating the flight for U.S. Airways, completed inspections on elevator controls of similar airplanes. Those planes are considered safe. For NPR News, I'm Amy Quinton in Charlotte.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 9 points to close at 8,784 in heavy trading. For the week, the Dow is up 183 points. This is NPR News. Police in Frankfurt, Germany have arrested two men on suspicion of belonging to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. The German Justice Ministry said the two Yemeni men were arrested in response to a request from the United States. One of the men was identified as a Muslim cleric who's said to lead a large mosque in Sana'a, the Yemeni capital. A Justice Ministry spokeswoman said she expected the two men to be quickly extradited to the U.S. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to review a controversial California state court ruling on free speech for businesses. That ruling allowed the Nike shoe company to be sued for allegedly making false and misleading statements in the course of defending itself and its products. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Nike, the world's largest manufacturer of athletic apparel, found itself in the eye of the worst kind of publicity storm in 1996. More than a dozen major media outlets featured allegations that the company was paying substandard wages and subjecting employees to sweatshop conditions in plants that manufactured its products in Southeast Asia. The company fought back with advertising, pamphlets, press releases, and letters to the editor. But a citizen lawsuit in California charged that Nike's factual statements were untrue and violated the state law banning false and misleading commercial statements. The California Supreme Court allowed the lawsuit to go forward, and Nike appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, contending that the lawsuit violated its First Amendment right of free speech. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 9 points to close at 1,447. For the week, the Nasdaq was up 60 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, this month sponsoring the PBS series Our Genes, Our Choices, a Fred-friendly seminar about the impact of genetics on people's lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The new film, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, is based on Chuck Barris's 1982 autobiography of the same name. Chuck Barris was the creator of The Dating Game, The Gong Show, and The Newlywed Game. That much is public record. Barris, however, claims in his autobiography that during his time as a game show host, he was recruited by the CIA to be an assassin. In the film, Barris is played by Sam Rockwell. George Clooney plays the agent who is out to recruit and train him.
I've never known a television producer before. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Okay. What's this money deal you were talking about?
I work for a government agency. Always looking for good, enthusiastic men to help us carry out our directives.
What kind of work? What government agency?
Problem-solving work. The Office of Diplomatic Security.
Is that the CIA or something?
Please be discreet, Mr. Barris.
Why me?
I'm happy to report you fit our profile, Mr. Barris. Are you interested in the work?
What's the profile?
Are you interested in the work, Mr. Barris?
Barris's story is so outlandish, no one appears to take it very seriously. Chuck Barris has refused to confirm or deny if he really was an assassin for the CIA. George Clooney, who also directed the film, has said that, like a good defense attorney, he didn't really want to know whether the story was true or not. But if it wasn't, he found it fascinating that someone as successful as Chuck Barris felt the need to write it. Barris invented a TV game show format that played on contestants' personal relationships. Some of the laughs came from watching people publicly embarrass themselves as they revealed things about their private lives. His first show, The Dating Game, gave a young single contestant the chance to cross-examine a hidden panel of eligible bachelors or bachelorettes and choose one for a chaperoned date.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you very much. Welcome to the Dating Game. We have three eligible bachelors ready to compete for a date with today's first lucky lady. Let's jump right in, and here they are. Bachelor number one. He's a financial analyst from California. He's into adventure and says nothing turns him on like a romantic rock climb. Give a hand to Ken Holmschild. Hey, Ken. Bachelor number two works in membership sales at a health club, and he says that one kiss from him will put sparks in any girl's heart. From Seattle, Washington, let's meet Ruben Hernandez. Hey, Ruben.
Welcome.
Bachelor number three is an artist from the Hamptons, and he loves to make collages for his girlfriend. Say hi to Steve Brambach. Steve.
Terry Gross spoke with Chuck Barris in 1986 and asked him about creating the format for The Dating Game.
It was a time of rock and roll heroes, you know, Beatles, the Dave Clark Five. And I try to think of a show in which three teenage girls would be separated by a wall from three kids, and one of them might be a rock star. And in some form or other, I was looking to match them up so that one of the girls would get the rock star and just faint from excitement. That never happened. But what did happen was one girl, three guys, or one guy, three girls, and any age, it could be any age. The premise evolved down to a celebrity, a very handsome, what I would call civilian, a celebrity, and then the nerd, the guy who you would go, oh, she picks him, who was generally a very personable with a great personality. And that was the ideal dating game, you know, with a very pretty, innocent girl. It didn't always work that way, but to this day, if I were doing the dating game, that's who I'd look for.
Did the nerd usually get chosen?
Invariably, because he had the best personality, you know.
And so when they went out on their date, was there a chaperone?
Yes. Well, originally, we the dates went in and around Los Angeles. And there really wasn't a need for a chaperone because they were chauffeur-driven, and a limousine in those days, that was pretty good. And the limousine driver more or less kept an eye on him. He worked for the company. He worked for Dating Game, you know, Chuck Barris Productions. But then, you know, the network came to me and said, you know, I wrote about it in Confessions, that they wanted something for nighttime. There was an opportunity for the Dating Game to go on prime time if I could come up with something different, and I couldn't figure out what could be different. And it dawned on me through a bunch of things that sending those dates instead of in and around L.A., make them these romantic dates to places all over the world. And that's when we needed a chaperone. I mean, that's when I remember saying to the network executives, well, they said, we can't send couples that are unmarried off for a weekend or a week. And they were right. And I said, well, we'll send a chaperone. So the chaperones turned out to be my employees. Anybody who was 21 or over, again, I made the rule. When you were, if you're 21 years old or more, you could chaperone a couple. And people who work for me, who worked at Chuck Barris Productions, kids, I mean, 21-year-olders, 22, 23, and all the way up, went everywhere. I mean, each week they were going off to Morocco, to Rio de Janeiro, to Hawaiian Islands, you know, Tahiti, Moscow. It was incredible. And it, they got, at first, you know, I had so much fun saying, Ralph, Paris, and he goes, oh my, he jumped, and I'd say, Mary, Stockholm. But then after about, you know, we were on for 8 or 9 years, and in the second year, I'd say, Ralph, North Africa, and he'd say, what part? You know, they became so blasé about it, I got furious. You
know? I'm thinking about how bad a blind date can be, and then imagining what it's like in Stockholm, trapped with somebody who you realize you're not very compatible with.
Well, that's scary. But what happened was that it became a threesome. It became a kind of a legal menage a trois in that the girl, the guy, and the chaperone sort of teamed up. The chaperone became one of the gang, and that's how it generally evolved. You know, if they didn't quite get along, no one had to stay with any one person. They could stay with the threesome, you know. And it worked out really well.
Did the chaperones end up falling in love with any of the women?
Yes, and vice versa. Because, you know, the kids that worked for me were young and kind of great.
Well, your next really big hit was The Newlywed Game, as if, you know, after you date, then you're married and you could go on The Newlywed Game.
Well, I looked to the household, you know, for my show ideas, because my shows, as I said, were people. And I wanted highly identifiable shows where the audience could identify with what was going on. I thought that was critical to the success of a daytime show. And, of course, the next logical step was after dating was marriage. So the newlyweds came with a reputation, you know, built-in reputation. It was slightly sexy, and it was this, that, and the next thing. And it was naive, and it was this. It worked fine. That worked fine. And I think The Newlywed Game was, and it turned out to be the best show I ever created, and ever would, I guess, if I wanted to put something in a time capsule, I'd put The Newlywed Game in there because it's so simple and it works. It's just need 4 couples, 8 questions, Bob Eubanks, and if we're 100 years from now, it'll be Bob Eubanks' great-great-grandson, and you'd have the potential of a very funny half hour if the questions were good. And I think that's what's so wonderful about the show. It's so basic. I also think it evolved into a microcosm of marriage as we know it. I mean, I think if anybody really loved their partner and respected their partner, they would never do The Newlywed Game. You couldn't put your partner up to so much potential embarrassment. However, I don't believe that in the great wash of marriage that most people love and respect each other. I think they get married for any number of reasons. That's not those two aren't some of them. It's, you know, it's time to be married. I'm at that age when I should be married. All the rest of us are married, or it's a thing to do. But it's rare when I believe, and maybe this is you know, extremely cynical, that people really marry because they really are truly in love with each other. So there was a newlywed game, and everybody was saying all those wonderful things, and I checked to see how divorce ran, and we had about a 40% divorce rate, and that's exactly how the country runs. So there was a newlywed game, as I say, a kind of a microcosm of marriage, but I think it has been, it still is, a very funny show.
What do you think appealed in that show to the listeners, the viewers?
The newlywed game, tremendous identification, and the spontaneity of it all. The awareness that these people were married less than a year, no matter what their age, and the fact that they might just say the silliest things. You know, we asked how many pints of blood would her husband say is in her body, and she'd start counting it off. She'd put a hand to her forehead, to her nose, and say one, from her nose to her chin and say two. You could never write that. And you'd have, and basically that was it.
Let's talk about some of the game shows that you tried that weren't as successful. One of which you just referred to, which is Three's a Crowd. What was the premise of that?
Well, there were two basically that weren't as successful. Very quickly, one that I remember distinctly. One was How's Your Mother-in-Law. I went to the mother-in-law next from the Newlywed Game. I just again thought the mother-in-law was much like newlyweds and dating. It was an institution that we all had a preconceived notion about. The one thing I failed to take into consideration was that the mother-in-law is somebody's mother, and you cannot really poke fun or in any way, you know, make fun of somebody's mother. And that really was a blanket across the show, that feeling. It just didn't work. It was funny, but you were always making fun of somebody that you really shouldn't be making fun of. So the mother-in-law game was a quick, short disaster. There were a couple of more shows that worked, and then we came to Three's a Crowd, which was a show I always believed was one of the great dramas that I could translate into a game show, and that I was convinced it would be the best. It was the very obvious triangle: who knows the husband better, the wife or the secretary? Again, I was looking for humor. I was looking for spontaneity, saying lines that you would never, you know, you could never write yourself. The preparation to the shows were fine. We ran through the questions. Everything seemed to work well. But something happened between the prep and the air. It became serious. It wasn't funny. I always prided myself in the fact that anybody that ever did my show had fun doing them. These people were not having fun. They were uneasy, ill at ease. Things were emerging from the show which were very unfunny and very embarrassing. And it came across through the screen like a rainstorm. I had that uneasy feeling, and I knew I was in deep trouble, that I'd created something that went against all those rules.
Well, how would you emotionally relate to somebody after a show who you felt was actually unnecessarily like embarrassed or humiliated or hurt as a result of the program?
I would be very, very upset. It didn't happen often. It happened rarely on all of our shows. I mean, what the critics said, which I always felt they were writing for each other, and what and how the people felt, I always felt were two different things. I thought the people always knew what we were trying to do, and the contestants or the acts or whatever were always having fun, no matter what happened. Mike Wallace challenged me on that once. He called me on a lady that fainted on a show called Treasure Hunt. She thought she had won a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or something. She ended up winning a Rolls Royce, and when she heard, she fainted. And Mike asked wasn't I orchestrating the emotions of these women for my own benefit? And I never could agree to that, because I know that lady was having a wonderful time. And so he checked her out, and he went to her house. He did it on 60 Minutes. But that was, and she did. She said she had a, there she was in her little, you know, those little short pants, you call them beach something or other in her little shirt that she wore on the program, and she said she had a great time. That was the way I always looked at things. When we ever hurt anybody, and we did that on Three's the Crowd, occasionally on a gong show, somebody would misjudge somebody and realize afterwards that they really were playing that seriously, that, you know, and were hurt by their rejection, I would feel very badly because that was never an intention, and it hurt me. And we took Three's the Crowd off the air.
Chuck Barris from a 1986 interview with Terry Gross. Barris's autobiography is the basis for the new film Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Chuck Barris, creator of The Dating Game, The Gong Show, and The Newlywed Game.
Let's talk about The Gong Show. Now, I know I used to watch Ted Mack's original Amateur Hour all the time when I was a kid, and I used to laugh all the time at the acts on there. And then when your show came on the air, it was a talent show, were you supposed to laugh at the acts who were on there? How did you dream The Gong Show up?
I thought first that we needed an outlet for talent. There weren't any variety shows, and there weren't any nightclubs anymore where you could go to see singers and comics and magicians and so forth. And I thought there must be out there tons of them. There's just no outlet. And I thought that called the Gong Show, whatever the name was, the talent show, would be the answer. I sold the premise to ABC, the television network, and then when I started auditioning, I realized there really weren't that many great acts, but there was an awful lot of bad acts out there. We went back and said we couldn't do the show, but then as an afterthought, I kept thinking, well, what if we reversed it? What if we did a parody on all these talent shows like Ted Mack and Major Bowes and what have you, and had more bad acts than good, and had this big gong and so forth, and that's how the show came to be.
And how did you become the host?
Well, that was an aberration. That was something that just was completely a fluke. The first host that we had when we mounted the Gong Show and went on the air, he had a wrong idea how that show should be. He thought it was an actual talent search. He felt this was serious. And what amazed me was that I could not get through to this man that this was not our point. The point of the show was humor, fun, parody. This was a camp talent show. Well, I knew the vehicle would work if we had the right guy hosting it. And since it was just a mechanical job at first, I replaced him, only temporarily, just for a week or two, till we could find the right guy. And I was so bad and so inept that I fit right in. I just sort of blended it right into the acts. And as a creator, I could see that this was working. It was the act and me against the world, you know. And we had a great rapport. And also, I had met that act through auditioning them and rehearsing them, so we did have, by the time we were on the air, a sort of a personal connection, and it worked. And I stayed on. I stayed on for 4 years, and I really never was a performer at heart. I had to wear a hat with a brim down over my eyes so I wouldn't see the audience for a while and things like that.
So that's how you developed the hat,
yes,
as a signature?
Sure. It became a signature, but originally I was doing it in rehearsal. Once I wore a hat and I realized that I could block out the audience by the brim, and I could still read the cue cards. So I started to wear it on the air. After a while, I'm sure I could handle the audience, but not in the beginning. I was frightened.
Were all the acts on there in on the joke? Do you think that they all got,
yes,
that it was a parody?
They should have, and most of them did. I must say that I don't believe 100% did. I think there was always that small percentage that may have thought that they were going to get a break, that this was that they were really good when they weren't. We did have good acts on. We had to just to have the difference so that you could set up a difference. But I'm sure I'm talking about the people that weren't good and thought they might be. But we try to establish among all the people there that this was the Gong Show, and they should know that going in. We never try to fool anybody. I did on occasion. I remember I once talked a guy into doing the show who sold books out in California, who I knew what at the time I was that I was misleading him. He was a terrible singer, and I wanted him on the show. And I kept telling him he was good. It really was. And when I had him on the show and he got gonged, he was hurt. And I realized what I had done and made sure I would never do that again.
What have you learned about television viewing habits? There's a line in your novel where you suggest that people are always eating when they watch TV. Do you think that's really true?
I do. I think that basically people are eating. They're either watching it at breakfast before they go to work, they're watching it at dinner when they come home, or they're eating a late dinner, or they're going to television to get a snack. Obviously, that's not a hard, fast rule, but I always told my staff that if we could stop a fork, you know, if we could stop a spoon or a fork midway from the bowl to the mouth, then we had done something right. We had just created a moment that was okay, you know, and that was the slogan that we carried around the company, stop a fork, stop a fork. And whenever we would say, hey, that sure stopped a fork, we knew that we had done something that made you laugh a lot or stopped your fork somewhere or other.
You have said that if there's a show that you could do, you'd really want to do a show called Greed. Do you want to explain how that would work?
I heard that as it was expressed to me not too long ago as a legend about a Chuck Barris joke. It wasn't a joke. It was I was trying to tell somebody what the critics or what the intellectual elite might consider the destiny of daytime television. That was a show called Greed, in which an old man, arthritic old man on crutches, would be standing there, and four contestants would be bidding down to see who would take the littlest amount of money to go out and kick the crutches out from that man. Now, you know, and then the next person out was a little boy and his dog. Well, you know, what would happen then? It was only my mouthing off as to what other people's concepts of what they thought daytime television might be trying to go to. And it was never in any way, shape, or form what I was trying to go to.
Chuck Barris talked with Terry Gross in 1986. The new film, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, is based on Barris's 1982 autobiography. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides. Providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. FINDLAW.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Queen Latifah on rapping and acting. She's currently starring in the film adaptation of Chicago. And David Edelstein reviews the new Roman Polanski film.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. In the new film Chicago, Queen Latifah plays the tough prison matron Mama, who does favors for her female prisoners in return for their intimate friendship and cold cash.
Ask any of the chickies in my pen. They'll tell you I'm the biggest mother hen. I love them all and all of them love me. Because the system works, the system called reciprocity. Got a little motto, always sees me through. When you're good to mama, mama's good. Prepared to do. You do one for mama, she'll do one for you. They say that life is tit for tat, and that's the way I live. So I deserve a lot of tat for what I've got to give. Don't you know that this hand washes that one too? When you're good to mama, mama's good to you.
That's Queen Latifah from the soundtrack of the new film, Chicago. Her performance earned her a Golden Globe Best Supporting Actress nomination. She also has a new album, a collection of hits released in December called She's a Queen. Queen Latifah's first CD in 1989 established her image as an Afrocentric independent woman who didn't like the misogynistic bent of some fellow rappers. The strength that she portrays in her music has carried over into her roles on TV and in the movies. She was one of the stars of the Fox sitcom Living Single and has co-starred in the movies Brown Sugar, Juice, Set It Off, and Living Out Loud. Terry spoke with Queen Latifah in 1999 after the publication of her autobiography, Ladies First. Let's start with her 1994 Grammy Award-winning record, Unity.
Another flow. Every time I hear a brother call a girl a bitch or a hoe, trying to make a sister feel low, you know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring breath to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block, I had my cutoff shorts on right, cause it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty, he was nasty. Yeah. I turned around red, somebody was catching the rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break fly. I punched him dead in his eyes.
Who you calling a bitch?
U-N-I-T-Y.
In this rap, you talk about what you don't like about bitch and hoe kind of language. Elaborate on that for me.
You know, honestly, the record was really made in response to, at the time, there were so many records coming out with, you know, rappers calling women, you know, bitch this, hoe that. And I just thought it was like getting out of control. It was becoming a bit too much. And I'm not saying that I don't, you know, use expletives when I'm hanging out with my friends, you know. And, you know, we may say some of those things, but we say it in joking. But when it's meant to be really derogatory or to disrespect people constantly, you know, it just got to be too much. And so I felt like saying something about it, you know.
Did you feel that that language represented larger attitudes toward women in the music world or the rap world or among your friends?
Well, definitely. Some people use that word to apply to all women, you know. And it seems like the word, I mean, I could call a guy an MF, but it's not going to be as harsh as him calling me a bitch. There's a difference. It sounds worse, and it feels worse. You know what I mean? So I felt like, you know, it's time somebody says something about it, because it's still out of control. It's still out of control, you know, but I think that that helped bring awareness to it. And the record wasn't so much about the word bitch. The record was about, the first verse is about that, you know, the respecting a woman. The second verse is about abuse, a woman being beaten by her man and finding the strength to leave. And the third verse was about young girls, like, who wanted to be tough, wanted to be gangster bees, you know what I mean? I mean, the record was really about a lot of different things, and the point of the record was unity. Let's bring it all together. Let's put all of this stupid stuff to the side, and let's be together, man. Let's stop pushing each other away from each other, and let's be down with each other.
Now, the first name that you rapped under was Princess of the Posse. How did you decide on that name for yourself?
No, Latifah was my name. The Princess of the Posse was just my little title, you know? Because I was like the only girl in our crew, and Ramsey was kind of like, Ramsey and DJ Mark the 45 King were like the heads of the crew, you know, so to speak. They were like the heads of the crew, but I didn't go with either one of them, so I couldn't be like their girlfriends or anything like that. So I just took I was like the little sister. So I took the princess title.
So what was it like being the only female in your posse?
I wasn't the only female, but I was the only female rapper. It felt good. I was cool with it, you know. And then all my friends, I introduced, like, a lot of my friends to the guys in my crew, and some of them hooked up with the guys in my crew. So it was, like, it was cool. We had a big old family. We had a female DJ, this girl named Ginger G. She used to DJ. So she was the female DJ, I was the female rapper, and, you know, we had a couple of other people, you know, down with us, but that was it, and it was actually a good experience for me, because I got to be around guys and see how they think and what they do, and they could be natural around me. They didn't really hide anything, you know, in front of me, because it wasn't like I was their girlfriend, you know, so they didn't have to front and, you know, be phony or whatever. I learned a lot, and then I had, you know, I had them right there to help me practice. We all practiced around each other. We were writing, and then we would bounce the rhymes off of each other to see what the other person thought and get constructive criticism. It was almost like a school for rap. It was real good.
How did you decide what you wanted your image to be?
I kind of just wanted it to not be like anybody else that was already out. So, you know, when the record company gave me some money to go shopping to take, you know, to get clothes and stuff for my promo pictures, you know, I didn't have a stylist, so they basically just gave me money to go shopping. So I went and bought, you know, a couple of outfits, you know, some stretch pants and a nice shirt or whatever, you know. But then I was walking down the street downtown in Newark called Halsey Street, and I passed this African store, and I had already decided my name was Queen Latifah by this point. And then I was looking at some of the clothing, and I liked the way that the pants were made. It was like a drawstring thing. It was beautiful embroidery. I saw this fabric, and I asked the lady, could she make me a suit, basically, you know, a shirt and some pants and a hat to match, like a crown. And she said she could do it, and she hooked it up for me, and it came out real cool. So I took my first promo pictures in it, and I was barefoot in these pictures, squatting with this African suit on, and it was like, whoa, who is this? You know, my look was just automatically different from then on.
It's good you had your clothes made, too, because you read in your book that you hated the full-sized women's shops. You didn't like the clothes in there.
Well, yeah, most of the time it's just some big, you know. I mean, things have gotten a lot nicer.
Uh-huh.
Since, you know, then I was, you know, that was like 10, 12 years ago or whatever. But, yeah, things have gotten, they've come a long way. You know, I still think that the bigger ladies need some really fly clothes to wear. Because most women that I know aren't just small women, you know. They need to have really nice things made for them so they can look just as beautiful as, you know, these little size sixes. It's all good. Share the love.
You write that when you were growing up, you were uncomfortable with your body because you were big. Is that something you had to get over before you started performing, or had you already gotten over that?
Yeah, I basically had gotten over that by then. I mean, my initial concern wasn't because I was big, because I wasn't like big fat, you know. I was bigger than every other girl in the class.
You were playing basketball.
Yeah, I was like always the tallest girl in the class, always the biggest girl in the class. Until like this other girl came to school named Shania, and I was so happy because she was bigger than me. And I didn't think it was possible, but I was so happy because she took the pressure off of me for a minute, which was nice. But it was like my breasts, you know, I developed my family, the women in my family are pretty well endowed up top. So I got pretty well endowed pretty early in life. I was like 11 years old, popping up with these things. And I'm like, oh, God, what do I do with this? What are you doing here? Why ye me? And then they just grew. So my friends would like tease me sometimes. They made me feel a little bit uncomfortable about it. But as I grew older, I grew to accept them. I grew to love my body, you know, and it was reinforced by certain people that I was involved with intimately. They loved it too. So I'm like, man, and now I love my breasts. This is the best thing in the world.
You know, you use your size on stage as power too.
Yeah, why not? I am statuesque. My stature goes right along with my personality.
Queen Latifah, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. She plays the prison warden Mama in the new film Chicago. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring a 1999 interview Terry Gross recorded with Queen Latifah. She stars in the new film, Chicago.
You have been doing, you know, a lot of acting. You were the star of the TV series, Living Single. You've been in several movies, including Juice and Get It Off. Is that what it's called?
Set it off.
Yeah, I saw it.
Get it off. What you thinking about over there? Huh? Set it off.
Set it off. And Living Out Loud.
Mm-hmm.
When you got into acting, had you planned to get into acting?
Well, it was something that I always wanted to do
since you were a kid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I acted in school plays and stuff. I never had any, like, really formal training, as in classes or anything like that. But I felt like I had a talent, you know, and I felt like it would be something good for me to do. And I wanted to do it because I never looked at myself like I'm the best rapper ever on the planet. And unless I could say that, then I would never be comfortable just being a rapper. I needed to diversify and have things to fall back on. So acting was definitely a passion that I wanted to pursue.
Your first movie was Juice, right?
My first movie was it Juice? Jungle Fever.
Oh, Jungle Fever. Okay, that was like a small role, very small role, right?
Yeah, one day.
Okay, and then in Juice you had a larger role, mm-hmm, as a DJ. So it was kind of pretty close to who you are.
Right.
You didn't have to, like, reinvent yourself completely.
No, exactly.
For that. Was that a good way to get started, you know, in a role that was pretty close to home?
Well, you know what? It was, I guess, in a way, but then it wasn't. You know, it was kind of like I got sick of playing what people thought Queen Latifah was in their scripts. Like, people would look at my image or who they thought I was, and then they'd write me in there, basically. But it wasn't me, you know? It wasn't me. I was much more rounded. Well, I was much more well-rounded than the linear characters that they kind of had me playing. And they were just like this remanufactured version of Queen Latifah. I was happy for the opportunity to be in a movie and kind of learn. So it was good learning some of those things without having to stretch too far from who I really am. But that's not something that can sustain you, and that's not something that can establish you as an actor. So I was dying for the role that was not me, that was not anything remotely like me, so that I could really show my skills, my talent.
What's the closest you've come to that, to a role that's not remotely like you?
Set It Off, Cleo.
And describe Cleo, your character.
Cleo and Set It Off. She was basically orphaned at a young age. She had no one left, really, but her friends. Her friends were the most important thing, you know, in her life to her. She would die for them. She was a very strong but real tender on the inside. She was a lesbian and in a monogamous relationship with someone, although she did like to flirt. And that was basically, she just really cared, you know, she kind of cursed a lot. She liked to drink and, you know, she liked to smoke her cigarettes. She was a little bit wild, but she was a very caring person. She really was really down for her friends, and that was like the bottom line.
Did you see a lot of homophobia surface after your performance?
No. You know, I didn't. People had love for that character, and that was what I really wanted to do. I wanted to make them really love her. You know, that character was so great and the script was so great for her because she got to really go all out for her friends. You had to love her. If you didn't care about her, then you needed to really examine your own emotions and your own feelings, because anybody who basically would say, look, you guys go, run, and take the heat, and knew she was going to take the heat, knew she was probably going to die, and knew she was going to meet her end, you know, but sacrificed herself so that her friends could try and, you know, could be free like that. That's a true, true trooper. That's a true friend. And so I figured that there's, you know, if you don't have love for this girl by the time this movie is over, you're just twisted. So, I mean, basically, there's a scene in there where I kiss this girl. And I have yet to watch this scene because I can't watch it, you know, myself. I don't think I could just watch myself be intimate, period. It wasn't the fact that she was a girl, but it was the fact that just I'm kissing somebody on it. I can't watch me do that, I don't think. But it was kind of funny because I went and saw the movie like 8 times, you know, when it came out, and I would see it in regular theaters, like creep in and just sit in the back of the theater and watch the movie with a regular audience to see how they reacted. And every time that kissing scene came, people was like, ah, ew, ooh. You know, you could hear this big roar in the theater. But by the time that the end of the movie came, they were like cheering for the girls, like cheering for us to like get away to win, you know. So they couldn't remember, you know. It wasn't like their mind stayed focused on that one thing, you know, which was good for me.
So they're cheering or jeering, and you're turning your head from the screen at the same time because you don't want to watch yourself being intimate?
Pretty much. Pretty much, yeah.
Queen Latifah plays the prison matron Mama in the new film Chicago.
Dana Owens, a.k.a. Queen Latifah. Yes, I'm here to testify. No, I got to speak on my behalf. You don't even know what happened. Can I just tell you what happened?
He had it coming.
He had it coming.
He only had himself to blame. If you'd have seen it, I think that you would have done the same.
I mean, imagine, why was he hitting this woman? Why was she taking that? Now picture her fighting back. Think of the ass kicking. Think of his ass flipping down the stairs. And me at the top smiling. He should have stopped wilding. Now could you picture me trying to finish him off? See why I pictured me on this side of the law? Leave holes, you'd have thought I was gunning. Now the cops coming, I ain't running. Girl, you should have seen it. Should have bobbed and weaved it before the cops came. Got a couple of clean hits. In word to Jesus, couldn't take the abuse, but I couldn't explain that to the state troops. But you know, girl,
yeah, you go, girl.
Plus, I look real cute in orange jumpsuits. This is the story I'm telling, and I ain't changing nothing. I just needed you to know, Your Honor.
He had it coming.
He had it coming.
He only had himself to blame.
You Queen Latifah with Lil' Kim and Macy Gray from the soundtrack of Chicago. Next Tuesday, Terry Gross will talk about the making of Chicago with the film's director and choreographer Rob Marshall, and also with Paul Bogave, who supervised and conducted the music. In the interest of full disclosure, Paul Bogave is my brother. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Pianist, the new film by Roman Polanski. This is Fresh Air. Roman Polanski's The Pianist is based on the life of Władysław Szpilman. He was a celebrated Warsaw pianist when the Nazis invaded Poland, and he survived the war in Warsaw. The Pianist won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival and was chosen Best Picture of 2002 from the National Society of Film Critics. It's a favorite of critic David Edelstein's. Here's his review.
The first time we see the title character of The Pianist, he's playing a Chopin nocturne live on Polish radio when German bombs hit the Warsaw station. It's 1939, and Władysław Szpilman, played by Adrian Brody, is annoyed. He wants to finish. He keeps playing after the technicians have fled until he's literally blown off his piano bench. And there, in those few seconds, is the central tension in the movie. It's between the artist's stubborn classical detachment and the violent contortions of the outside world. As the Nazis round up and brutalize the Jews of Warsaw, The Pianist pushes that tension to the breaking point. The movie is grueling, for long stretches wordless, yet nothing in its nearly 2.5 hours feels unnecessarily prolonged. Roman Polanski and his screenwriter, the English playwright Ronald Harwood, keep the scene short and severe, framed by fade-outs and fade-ins, like cruel blackout sketches. Not long after bickering about where to hide what little money they have, Szpilman and his family watch from their apartment window as a wheelchair-bound old man in a building across the street is dumped off a balcony, then the rest of his family shot down and run over. The sequence, with its helplessly restricted vantage, is like a circus of horrors viewed by someone frozen to a seat in fear. It's no wonder the Jews go collectively insane, that they even come to prey on one another. Szpilman's stature gives him an edge. He makes money playing in a ghetto cafe, where the Jewish beau monde tries to act as if nothing has changed. And he has an offer to work for the collaborationist Jewish police. The offer sickens him, but it's the collaborator who made it who pulls him out of the long procession that leads to the freight train to Treblinka, where the rest of his family will perish. Szpilman is treated as a kind of precious commodity. He's shuttled by a small network of artist friends from apartment to apartment, while he slowly wastes away from lack of food, human contact, and music. The Pianist is classical in its rigor, but radical, I think, in the camera's eerie distance from the central action. Through windows, from a fixed perspective, the pianist watches the Jews starved, shot, and deported. He watches the Polish resistance make a final stand. He watches the remaining inhabitants of the ghetto mount a rebellion that is crushed. History goes by while he peers out from his hiding place, sometimes pretending to play a piano that for fear of discovery he can't actually touch. This is a major performance by Adrian Brody. Brody lost 30 pounds from his already skinny frame. And no, I don't think that torturing your body and mind and great acting go hand in hand. But in this case, you can feel as if you're watching someone actually suffer, and in that suffering hit notes you've never heard before. One of my colleagues has complained that the film doesn't tell you what Spielman learned from this experience. I'd say he learned that when people want to kill you, you hide. And if you're starving, you look for something to eat. I'd say he learned that if the world is a circus of horrors, then there's a kind of heroism in clinging to Chopin. Because maybe, with your art, you can still touch someone, even a Nazi someone, with a glimpse of a higher order. For those who believe that art should be a more radical force for change, Polanski's validation of Spielman's detachment might seem like a bourgeois or even sentimental notion. But there's no sentimentality in The Pianist. It's drenched in stoicism. The detachment of the artist is a force of nature in its own right, not a match for fascism. That would be sentimental, like the movie Life is Beautiful, but more than just a palliative. Polanski has said that he could only tell his own story of escaping as a small boy from the Krakow ghetto, where his mother died, through Spielman's eyes. That story is not so much in the movie's events, but in its tone. We can feel in The Pianist the source of the cruel stoicism in Polanski's other work, even in his early films, before the senseless murder of his pregnant wife, Sharon Tate. He had to deaden something in himself to survive. Yet an artist can't be deadened. And so the compromise is this rigorous detachment, which allows him to show us without flinching the kind of horror and the kind of heroism that other directors are afraid to go near.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton about growing up in the black middle class, campaigning for civil rights, writing the first guidelines on sexual harassment, and her work in Congress. Eleanor Holmes Norton is the subject of a new biography. Join us for the next Fresh Air.